Okay, good morning. It's roughly 10:02, and I'll call this special meeting of the Board of Regents to order, and I'll ask our Chief of Staff, Karen Niklojewski, to take roll.
Chair Brooks.
Here.
Vice Chair Goodman.
Here.
Regent Arascotta.
Here.
Regent Batista.
Here.
May I ask for quiet in the audience, please? Regent Boylan.
Aye.
Regent Brager.
Here.
Regent Brown.
Present.
Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Downs.
Here.
Regent Fernandez.
Present.
Regent Goicoechea.
Here.
Regent McGrath.
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Regent Boylan, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I'll now move to agenda item number one, public comment. For those who'd like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 933-5568-7402 and passcode 555-555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None in Reno.
Thank you.
Well, I'd take that back. I take that back. There are two.
Okay. Thank you. I think we have an audio issue because we can't hear at the system office.
Can you hear me okay?
Thank you. Now we can.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. My name is Rachanya Dev Chinnappan, and I serve as the president of the Graduate Students Association at the University of Nevada, Reno. I'm providing public comment on the agenda item number 5 concerning the proposed graduate faculty and staff housing project at 600 University Way. While we fully recognize and appreciate the university's effort to expand housing availability, the projected rents of $1,900 for one bedroom and $2,400 for a two-bedroom unit are deeply concerning. These rates are simply not affordable for graduate students. To put this in perspective, PhD graduate assistant students at UNR typically earn about $2,200 per month before taxes, and master's students earn around $1,700 per month before taxes. At those income levels, even the least expensive proposed unit would consume 80 to over 100% of the graduate student's income, before accounting for basic needs such as food, transportation, and healthcare. Graduate students are an essential part of the university's academic and research mission, yet many already struggle to secure table and affordable housing in Reno's tightening rental market. Developing new housing that is priced beyond our means risk widening that gap rather than solving it. We strongly urge the university and the project partners to prioritize affordability measures, whether through income-based pricing or graduate student set-asides and subsidized rates, to ensure that this project truly meets its intended goal of supporting the graduate student and academic community. Thank you for your attention and continued support of graduate education at UNR. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ginger Doe, J-I-N-G-E-R-D-O-E. I currently serve as the Faculty Senate Chair at Truckee Meadows Community College, as well as the Chair of the Council of Chairs. Good morning, Chair Brooks, Vice Chair Goodman, Regents, and Chancellor McNair. I am speaking in support of Agenda Item 6, the Handbook Revision to Title 4, Chapter 4, regarding collective bargaining. I wish to express our thanks to the Regents, Chancellor McNair, Chief General Counsel Martinez, and Deputy General Counsel Parker for the commitment to shared governance. The Council of Chairs, as well as Dr. Pete Martini, were able to meet with Chief General Counsel Martinez and Deputy General Counsel Parker to discuss the proposed changes, as well as clarification around the changes. The Council of Chairs are supportive of the current revisions that are before you today. Thank you for your commitment to shared governance.
Good morning. My name is Jennifer McClendon. I'm chair of the UNR Faculty Senate. I want to share faculty concerns about Agenda Item 8, which appears to shift oversight of several important system councils, including the Public Safety Council, the Business Officers Council, and the Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Council from the Board of Regents to administrative control. Faculty across our campuses understand the desire to streamline processes, but as a faculty member who works closely with students and colleagues, I know how much these forums matter. They ensure transparency and give people who are most affected by the decisions a voice. That's not bureaucracy, that's shared governance, and it's one of the cornerstones of our university system. We are especially concerned about what this means for safety and inclusion. Not much time has passed since the UNLV shooting, and our campuses continue to face threats and lockdowns. The Public Safety Council is one of the spaces where campuses coordinate and improve readiness together. Its oversight must remain in public view. Likewise, the IDEA Council ensures that access and inclusion remain part of how we define student and employee success. Changing or eliminating that council without public oversight risks undermining that commitment. To change or dissolve it without transparent review could send the wrong message at precisely the time we need unity and trust. We respectfully urge the Board of Regents to retain their oversight of these councils. If a council should be retired for any reason, UNR faculty believe those discussions should take place openly, where the reasoning is clear and stakeholders have an opportunity to provide input. Efficiency should never come at the expense of trust, transparency, or safety. On behalf of the UNR faculty, thank you for listening to our concerns, and thank you, as always, for your continued service to our campus and communities.
That's all from me now.
Thank you. We'll now move to public comment here in Las Vegas.
Okay. Able to hear me okay? Okay. Good morning, Regents. My name is Andrew Lavengood, and I am the State Board Vice President of the Nevada Faculty Alliance, and I am an instructor of mathematics and statistics at CSN. I'm here this morning on behalf of our statewide membership and the State Board of NFA to express our gratitude for being invited into the room to contribute to the proposed revisions of Title IV, Chapter 4. Special thanks to our colleagues and Faculty Senate Chairs for graciously extending the invitation to be in the room. While we appreciate that these revisions are in a better place now, we maintain that we should see all proposed revisions at the same time to ensure that they fit together in the way that they are intended to fit together. In the future, we hope that you will continue to seek robust feedback from various constituency groups, be they Senate, NFA, or academic and administrative faculty at large. We also hope that you will incorporate that feedback to ensure you have a more polished version of what it is you are setting out to achieve with these revisions. Thank you again for your time, and we hope that you have a productive meeting and a restful weekend. Thank you.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Corey Fernandez, CoreyFernandez, for the record. I'm a professor at Nevada State University, and I want to begin by expressing my gratitude to Chancellor McNair and Chair Brooks for visiting our campus multiple times to hear from faculty and students as we navigate this period of transition at Nevada State. It means a great deal to us that you actively seek our feedback, and I hope you will continue to visit in the future. We're very proud of the work we do at Nevada State and would welcome the opportunity for you to see that firsthand. That said, there has been a breakdown in executive leadership, and the effects of that breakdown have trickled down to impact faculty, staff, and the programs we offer to our students. The trust between faculty and university leadership has eroded. And many feel blindsided by the recent changes, while others believe these changes were long overdue. Regardless of where one stands on this, it's clear that the best path is forward, and we need new leadership and a national search for a new president. And on this point, faculty are united. However, given that fracture in trust, we face an important question: who can effectively lead us during this transition? And on this point, there are more differences in opinion. I believe continuity is important, though, and Dr. Lopez Lassiter, if named acting president, has work to do to rebuild the relationship between academic and administrative faculty, as well as classified staff. Faculty want to know what happened. An external audit of our budget and open communication surrounding dismissals and investigations would be important steps towards restoring confidence. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Pete Martini, M-A-R-T-I-N-I. I am an associate professor of psychology at Nevada State and president of NSU's NFA chapter. I'm here today to express gratitude on several fronts. First, gratitude to Chancellor McNair, Chief General Counsel Martinez, and Deputy General Counsel Parker for the work that they did on Title IV, Chapter 4. We are grateful, NFA is grateful to be included in that process, and I think the process that we engaged in with our Faculty Senate colleagues shows in the product you all will be talking about later today. I'd also like to express gratitude to Chair Brooks and Chancellor McNair for their multiple trips to Nevada State to discuss how faculty feel about the upcoming transition. I believe that the robust conversation we had and the probing questions that were asked by the chair and the chancellor helped lead to the recommendation that you all will have before you today. I'd also like to take a moment to impress upon you that faculty, as my colleague said, are united at Nevada State on the need for a national search, but as important as that, the need for that search to be conducted by a reputable higher education executive search firm. I think this board has seen in the past what has happened when we haven't gone with academic executive search firms, and the faculty at Nevada State are robust in our deeply held belief that our way forward with our next president comes by virtue of a reputable academic search firm that specializes in academic executives. I hope you'll take that opinion to heart when you have that discussion later today. I hope you all have a productive meeting.
Good morning. My name is David Cooper, D-A-V-I-D-C-O-O-P-E-R, and I'm an associate professor of chemistry in Nevada State. First, I would like to thank the board for working with the faculty senates and the NFA to address the language in the handbook revisions for item number 6. I think good progress is made, and the new language is better off to the combined efforts of us all. I would also like to thank Chair Brooks and Chancellor McNair for their visit this past month to understand and get feedback from the various groups at NSU regarding the presidential search. I am hopeful that the board will respect the voiced opinion of faculty, staff, and students and choose to go with the national search from academic search firm for our next president with all due haste. I believe that in order to help Nevada State accomplish our mission of offering quality teaching and accessible degree programs, we will need a leader with experience at a 4-year primary undergraduate institution like ours, and the national search would offer the best chance to find this person. I personally am also supportive of the Chancellor's recommendations for the acting president and have been encouraged by the actions already taken in the effort to correct course and fix some of the issues at our institution. While there are still some problems that need to be corrected, I am hopeful that, with the help of the Chancellor and perhaps a consultant, the remaining issues can be corrected quickly to allow for a smooth transition without needing to go to the registry and waiting for an outside perspective to gain the lay of the land and get up to speed. Thank you.
My name is Dr. Ariel Santos. That's A-R-I-E-L-S-A-N-T-O-S for the record. As a member of the graduating classes of 2012, 2015, and 2020, and an instructor here at UNLV for the past 12 years, I feel that I'm in a good position to speak about the implications of a recent policy enforcement change around PTI workload. For those that may be unaware, last Wednesday, the word was passed down that PTIs, at least in some departments, would only be allowed to teach 11 credit hours per semester going forward after this semester. For most instructors in the College of Liberal Arts like myself, this effectively means that we are only allowed to teach 3 sections per semester when we have been able to teach 4 for as long as I can remember. This is effectively a 25% pay cut for PTIs like me without any explanation or justification. Nearly 50% of all classes taught at UNLV are currently taught by PTIs. 100 and 200 level classes, many of the gen eds and prereq classes for our degree programs are taught by this class of instructor. Most of these instructors have the same credentials as their tenure track colleagues, and in many cases have even more practical classroom experience. Put simply, students don't make it to the fancy 400 level classes without going through us. To speak to the broad negative impacts of the adjunctification of higher education would take more time than I will take from this meeting today. Adjuncts make up a large portion of our labor force at the university, and they are also the class of employees least likely to make a livable wage or have anything that could amount to job security. Most PTIs work with 5-month contracts, and we have not had a meaningful cost of living adjustment to our per credit compensation in many years. Indeed, during legislative budget negotiations in 2023, PTIs were completely left out of the raises. My requests of this board today are simple and twofold. In the short term, repeal this policy enforcement change and allow us to teach to our full capacity. In the longer term, I would ask this body to add PTI contract negotiations as a future agenda item, and that representatives from the PTI community be a negotiating partner in this process.
Thank you for your comment.
Good morning, Regents. It's Molly Apple. I'm APPEL. I am Associate Professor of English and speaking just for myself today to Agenda Item 2 and 3. And I want to echo my colleagues in thanking each of the Regents and Chancellor, of course, who has engaged directly with us and our leadership and our constituency on these matters. I was Faculty Senate Chair 2 years ago. Oh, and I should say, not bury the lead. I'm here to speak in support of Dr. Lopez-Lassiter and for a national search with a higher ed firm. When I was chair 2 years ago, we hired former Provost Frye and our current CFO, and I've continued working in shared governance spaces since then. And I cannot speak to the inner workings of executive team, but what I've witnessed from the outside is the steady erosion of trust and collegiality, leading to the erosion of genuine opportunity for dialogue without fear of some form of defensiveness or other retaliation. And since Dr. Lopez-Lassiter has taken up the officer in charge, it has been the first time since I was chair that I've seen decisive action being taken from the top towards amending these challenges in a way that is visibly responsive to the internal constituent concerns and experiences that we've had. I believe executive team, that each of them is working for the good of our university and for our students, that they believe that. But multiple things are true at once, and the impact of the infighting there has been deeply felt and reverberated throughout our campus. And so Dr. Lopez-Lassiter has begun this important work that I think has been missing for the past 2.5 years, and there's still much trust, much broken trust and transparency issues to be repaired. So I implore her to continue this work. And I would also implore her that if she wishes to remain president beyond the acting period, that she recuse herself from this acting appointment and join what would hopefully be a national search. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Regents. Laura Nauman for the record, N-A-U-M-A-N-N. I am currently faculty at Nevada State. I serve on our faculty senate and on our collective bargaining council as associate negotiator. I know you have before you today the decision on our acting president and the procedure for our search. I know it's being informed by lots of information that you've heard from my colleagues today, things you've read in the news, even emails you've received from our former provost. And as an aside, despite her dismissal, I do hope any of her allegations are taken seriously and investigated, and if there are findings, people are held to account. But in all of that, the decision that you have before you obviously is very hard, and I wish I had an easy and straightforward answer for you. It's messy. Our faculty are very concerned about the reputation of our institution in light of all of the recent changes. I can also not bury my lead. I'm here in support of Dr. Lopez-Laster, but I do want to be clear that many of our faculty are split on that decision, and a lot of it is based on the erosion of trust that you've heard that has been going on for the last several years. That climate of fear that you've read about, the fear to speak up and fear of retaliation, those things are true. I think some of the faculty who are still out on their decision remain concerned that Dr. Lopez-Laster might be a Pollard 2.0 because she's seen as part of an administration that condoned poor administrator behavior. We currently have no mechanisms to evaluate our administrators, and so faculty have tried to use whatever means possible to raise the alarm. I think one place that we can look is Pollard's evaluation, point four that this board wrote. I quote, this includes, it's under deepened faculty support and academic well-being. This includes addressing concerns around internal communication, promoting shared governance, and ensuring that faculty voices are meaningfully integrated into the decision-making process. All of those things still remain true, even though Dr. Pollard is not with us anymore. So I urge this board to consider these details. I'm in support of Dr. Lopez-Laster, but you have a tough job ahead of you. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any more public comment here, so we will move to, I'm sorry, what's that? Thank you. Thanks for the reminder. I appreciate it. SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
Yes, there is, Mr. Chair. Caller with the phone number ending in 2559, please press *6 to unmute, state and spell your last name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the board.
Hello, my name is Rochelle Bassen, B-A-S-S-E-N for the record. I am currently WNC NFA chapter president, and I just want to make a quick comment to extend my appreciation for including NFA reps with faculty senate chairs at the table for reviewing the revisions for Title IV, Chapter 4 on item number 6. So going forward, I certainly hope that this experience encouraged you to extend the same shared governance process when you consider future changes. Thank you.
Caller with the phone number ending in 2513, please press *6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the board. We'll move to the next caller. Caller with the phone number ending in 8258, please state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the board.
Hi, good morning, Regents. My name is Giselle Gradilla, G-R-A-D-I-L-L-A. I want to first express my gratitude to my Regent representative, Mr. Aaron Bautista. I'm calling in as both a Nevada State alum and as a concerned local K-12 educator as it pertains to Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 6. As a student of Nevada State, I've benefited greatly from the diverse, equitable, and all-around community-oriented focus that this institution and others in the Nevada region once staunchly championed. I'm living proof that councils such as IDEA are necessary and helpful to students like myself who dream of a future where they not only belong in higher education, but can also survive the landscape, which was not primarily made for us. As a current high school educator, I'm incredibly disillusioned and terrified for my current students as they approach their time in the higher education landscape here, particularly without necessary counsels such as IDEA. Regents and Chancellor, I implore you to remind yourself of your humanity and stand for the continuation of IDEA. My students, your students, our students are counting on you.
Okay, and the next caller with the phone number ending in 7404, please press *6 to unmute, state and spell your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the board.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Dr. Marcela Rodriguez Campo, MarcelaRodriguezCampo. I am the former director of diversity, equity, and inclusion at Nevada State University, as well as a former advisory member of the Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Council. I'm calling today on item number 8, to express to you all my grave concern for the possible request to decodify the Idea Council. The Idea Council, as was mentioned prior, is one of our sacred forms of shared governance and accountability for this board, as well as one of the ways in which that we ensure that all students within our system are served. Our system is a minority-majority system. This council is one of the primary ways that our institutions have been able to ensure that we are able to service all of the students that attend our universities. Unfortunately, decodifying the Idea Council would leave the council vulnerable to being eliminated. It is clear that this board is taking efforts and progressing in its, you know, agenda to abandon its commitments to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it is more important than ever that we double down and that we ensure that we protect the important work that allows us to service all students who pay their tuition, who attend our institutions, and who are the future of our state. I urge the Board of Regents to ensure that they vote no on item 8, because this particular council is a council that has been able to advance different items like the NC Juneteenth resolution, the equity statement, maintaining the anti-discrimination, anti-bias training, supporting the regents and providing training, providing scholars and experts to inform policy and best practices, and ultimately to ensure that our system is a much more inclusive and supportive environment. And by abandoning the Idea Council, we are telling the students of our state that we are willing to abandon not only our values, but them in the process. Please make sure that you do not decodify the Idea Council and allow for its important work to continue. Thank you.
Can our final caller with the phone number ending in 2513, please press *6 to unmute, state and spell your last name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to address the board. That's all the callers we have at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And then at this time, we'll move to agenda item number 2, the appointment of acting president at NSU. Now, there are two parts to this agenda item, and I want to make sure that board members have ample opportunity to discuss both the appointment recommendation and the proposed employment contract. First, I'll ask Chancellor McNair to present his recommendation for appointment, and I will open the floor to regents for interview questions, discussions, and a possible motion, and then we'll move to discuss and a possible motion on the employment contract. Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair. Regents, Matt McNair, NC Chancellor, for the record. After consulting with the Chair and the Vice Chair and groups on and off Nevada State who care about Nevada State a great deal, I'm recommending that the Board appoint Amber Lopez Lassiter as the Acting President of Nevada State University.
Thank you, Chancellor. That was straight to the point. I appreciate that.
Don't want to waste any time.
Thank you. At this time, what I'd like to do is call on Regent DelCarlo to ask her first interview question.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. So, Dr. Lopez Lassiter, hold on, let me get my note. Okay, what are your top three priorities that you want to accomplish as acting president of Nevada State University?
Thank you so much for the question, Regent DelCarlo. Amber Lopez Lassiter, for the record. I think you all heard this morning through public comment, we definitely have our work to do when it comes to the restoration of trust and some of the basic civility components when it comes to Nevada State. And so one of my first priorities will be to continue working closely with our governance group. So that would include Faculty Senate, both on the academic and the administrative side, Classified Council, as well as student government. In addition to that, we have a whole host of different initiatives that had started related to reorganization of student support services, STAR. I want to make sure that in terms of efficiencies and overall operations, that those are being attended to. Had many conversations with you around the budget and want to ensure everyone here, our biennium budget is balanced, but we do have work to do in terms of tightening things up to ensure that the institution is in solid shape when it comes to FY28.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Are there any other regents with questions for Dr. Lassiter? Seeing none, then is there a motion to approve the appointment of Dr. Amber Lopez Lassiter to the position?
Susan Brager, for the record, I would make a motion to accept the appointment of Amber Lopez Lassiter as acting for the system at NSU.
Second.
Thank you. So we have a motion by Regent Brager, a second by Regent Brown for the appointment of Dr. Amber Lopez Lassiter. Is there any more discussion? Regent Boylan?
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. Just a couple of points. I had lunch with Dr. Lassiter. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed it. Thank you. I got to know you a wee bit. I think this board has failed in letting things go on the way they did at NSU, and we didn't know about it. And if you guys did know about it, why didn't you do something about it? I didn't know about it. I thought everything is hunky-dory and it's great out there and everybody loves each other and they're holding hands and singing Kumbaya and such. But obviously we have issues there. And I was really in favor of Dr. Amber, but now I'm not. We've got to do the right thing. It's a really difficult situation for me, so I'm going to ask legal, if I don't vote on this item, do they take me away in handcuffs and chain me to the wall or something? I might enjoy it, so be careful what you say.
Regent Boylan, your special counsel, Chris Nielsen, no, you will not be locked up and taken away if you vote no on this.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, that's what I was worried about. Because I cannot vote on this topic until we have more investigations. There's just too much going on there that we don't know about. And to sit back quietly and say, well, lots of people want this and lots of regents want this, so we'll go with it. But I'm not pleased with what's happening there. And we need more information. We need more investigations. We need to find out. Yes, you can go after me. I'll be the chair for now. Yeah, but no, we need to find out more about this. This is not right. How many other institutions are out there? The same thing is happening, and we don't know about this. We are not doing our duty as elected officials, as regents.
Chair,
is my 2 minutes up?
I think you've made your point, Regent Boylan.
All right.
Thank you very much.
We have a couple
of regents in the queue.
Yes.
The first is Vice Chair Goodman.
I'm sorry, Jim Martinez, for the record, if I could just interrupt very quickly. I just wanted to clarify Regent Boylan's question. If your question was whether or not you can vote no on the item, which of course you can, or whether or not it would be appropriate for you to abstain on this item. And I think that's a question we need clarification on, because you do have a duty to vote on any matter that you don't have an actual reason for abstention.
That's my reason, you know, to abstain. That's the nice word, you know, abstain. And what happens to me? Are you going to throw me off the board? Are you going to lock me up? What's going to happen? There's nothing that's going to happen. And I don't agree with what's happening right now at that university. And I want more investigation, so I'm going to abstain.
Okay.
So
Chair,
am I okay?
Thank you.
Chair brought up a amount of ad. I interpreted Regent Boylan's question as whether he has if he votes no, anything happens. And I just want to echo what General Counsel Martinez says, is you all have a legal duty to vote on every item, unless you have a conflict that you disclose on the record and make an abstention. And so, that's part of the reason why we have our ethics training at the beginning of each year. I think, so you generally have a legal duty to vote up or down.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate Regent Boylan's comments. I think what I'd like to do is move to other regents who have some questions, but I believe that we all understand the point that you wanted to make, Regent Boylan, and the point that our council wanted to make. Vice Chair Goodman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's important to recognize the fact that I think that's part of the reason why we have talked about doing the listening sessions and why the chancellor and the chair move forward to do the listening sessions is so that we can actually go to campuses and talk to all of the different constituencies and really get an idea of what's happening on campuses. And I think moving forward, we should implement this as something that we do every year. I think it doesn't hurt to go to each campus and hear from everyone, and I think it'll help us have a better finger on the pulse of what's taking place on the varied campuses. So moving forward, I think that's something that we should definitely do, and I appreciate your sentiment. At the same time, I do think that the end game here is to have a national search and get a really wonderful president in Nevada State. And I do think that Dr. Lopez Lassiter will be able to continue moving forward with the help of the chancellor. Thank you.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. I just wanted to say that I've been aware of issues at Nevada State University, so none of this came as a surprise to me, and my first inkling on one of them was at a national conference I attended. Somebody from another state alerted me to something, and I came back and picked up the phone and made some calls and inquiries and was correct in what I had heard and shared that information. So I have full support of Amber as the acting president today. I think she has done an excellent job communicating with the board and has had very, very detailed explanations of what she is doing. No institution's perfect. When people leave, things come out. And I would say that she's already has addressed issues, whether you agree or disagree with how she's addressed them and what she's done. She's in that role as the OIC. And we give her full authority. Anyone that, if our campuses, that's an OIC position, they have the full power and weight of the presidency when they're in that role. So I have full support and am happy to vote to put her in as acting today. Thank you.
Chair, when you come back to me.
Regent Fernandez.
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Chair. I just wanted I want to say thank you to the Chancellor for this recommendation. I think it's a really important one and a really great way for us to allow you as the Chancellor to help govern, right, in the day-to-day. I also want to give, my respect to Dr. Amber Lopez Lassiter. The things that Nevada State University has been able to do and the way that it's been able to remain in motion and really high speed has been amazing. I think being able to hear from faculty and staff come here before us and speak really clearly about some of the issues and acknowledging that. And I really do appreciate that there's ownership on all ends, right? If there is a problem, I know that is something that you've even just shared now, that you want to be able to ensure that there is a solution. And I think that seeing in the past few meetings where faculty, staff, students have come in support of Dr. Amber Lopez Lassiter makes this a really easy and simple vote for me. So thank you.
Regent Borland.
Thank you, sir. He stole my thunder there. I was going to thank Chancellor because that's what we hired him for. But it's really difficult for me to come to any conclusion with not knowing what's really happening out there. Even we are getting secondhand information from you and from Vice Chair Goodman. We didn't go there. We were not invited to these hearing sessions. I think it might be a good idea that all the regents are invited, so we cannot say afterwards, I don't know what's happening out there. So I think it's a great idea. This communications is important to this board so we can make the right decision. And can I, counsel, make a motion to chair this for some other time? Is that possible since there's already one out?
Well, we have a motion on the floor
in a second.
So we have to move forward with that, and then depending on the outcome of that. But right now the agenda item is whether or not to approve to make the appointment or not.
Thank you. So it wouldn't do any good to say chair this, right?
Thank you, Regent Borland.
Table this one.
So there's just a couple of
agenda items. Sorry, sir.
That's okay. There were just two quick things to address that Regent Borland brought up. One, I think the public comment that we got today was indicative of what the chancellor and I heard on the campus. It's mixed, and that came across very, very clear today during public comment. And the other comment you made is it would be fantastic for our regents to be a part of some of these listening sessions. It would be extraordinarily beneficial for regents to have a clear understanding of where different stakeholders at our institutions sit with issues that are happening at the institution. The biggest challenge to that is we fall under OML. And when we have a meeting like that, it would have to be a public meeting. And the benefit of having a chancellor and perhaps a chair meet with folks is that those meetings are a little bit more intimate. They're essentially off record. And so the conversation flows, I think, in a manner that provides some significant transparency. Are there, for discussion, are there any other, Regent Breger?
Susan Breger, for the record, I'd like to ask legal a question because I think the listening sessions could be done more than one time. And I think if chair and vice chair go, I believe two other regents could be there without breaking open meeting law. Is that correct? Whoever, either one of you.
Yeah, this is Special Counsel Nielsen. I believe your question is it triggers a potential open meeting law issue whenever you get together outside of a meeting that's not noticed. And generally the rules are the quorum or seven, but we're always mindful of, you know, quorums of committees, but I think the short answer is, Regent Breger, that I think they're outside of this agenda item. I think there's an ability to perhaps have multiple listening sessions to receive the input that you need.
Thank you. I just think that would be very important, and because the whole board votes on these issues, and the only other thing I'll say is that we hired a chancellor to make decisions, and if we start overstepping those decisions, then we cannot hold that chancellor accountable. And so you get on the line that you're micromanaging anyone, that you is not to a specific person. Micromanaging comes into play, and that is something I ran my campaign on, and I think we need to be very careful, because if we were to change something like this due to a vote, then the chancellor's not accountable, we are. And that is not a good thing to do as far as I'm concerned.
Chair, if I may.
Just one moment, Regent Boylan, because yes, our Chief of Staff, Karen Nikolajewski, has a comment as
okay.
well.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen Nikolajewski, Chief of Staff, for the record. Bringing it back to this agenda item for a moment and not just general listening sessions, I just wanted to make sure everyone understands the board's policy with respect to constituent meetings for a president vacancy is that it is the chair, the vice chair, and the chancellor that go to the campus and gather that input. General listening sessions, something different, but for this policy, it's those three specifically.
Thank you for the clarification. Regent Boylan?
Thank you, sir. I said chair instead of table, and a few people giggled, and that's always good because I like to bring levity to these serious meetings, so I was just clearing that up. If we could table this motion is what I said.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. There is a motion on the floor. It was made by Regent Breger to appoint Dr. Amber Lopez-Lasser to the position of acting president of Nevada State University, effective October 18, 2025. It was seconded by Regent Brown. I believe we're at the end of our discussion regarding this specific agenda item piece, and I'd ask the Chief of Staff, Nick Lajewski, to please do a roll call vote. I'm sorry. Roll call vote.
Regent Arriscada.
Yes.
Regent Batista.
Yes.
Regent Boylan.
I abstain.
Regent Breger.
Yes.
Chair Brooks.
Yes.
Regent Brown.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho.
Yes.
Regent Del Carlo.
Yes.
Regent Downs.
Yes.
Regent Fernandez.
Yes.
Regent Goicoechea. Yes. Vice Chair Goodman.
Yes.
Regent McGrath.
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you. Congratulations, Dr. Lasseter, for taking on this role of acting president at NSU. We'll now move into the second part of this agenda item, and that has to do with the employment contract. And so what I'll do is I'd like to open up the floor to regents for any questions, discussion, and possible motions specific to the contract. Are there any regents with questions?
If there are no questions, I'd like to make a motion for approval.
Second.
So we have a motion to approve the employment contract by Regent Brager, a second to approve the employment contract by Regent Brown. Is there any discussion regarding the contract?
Discussion and
Regent Arascata.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate your time. I think it's the right direction that we're going right now. Having Dr. Amber Lassiter Lopez in the position of acting is good. It's thoughtful and it's mindful of the future of Nevada State University. However, moving a salary to this elevation would go against everything that we took an oath of office for. Well, we raised our right hand and committed to the system of higher education. We took the office to be mindful of the fiduciary aspects, the aspects of the system. And I realize that it is in the P&G manual of the minimum. But for me, I just cannot. I feel that it would be difficult for the morale throughout the system, for other leadership that especially been here for decades, to elevate this level of salary for, and I say this out of the most respect, for a person who's never sat in the captain's seat. And I understand there's a co-pilot seat, but this is a position of high regard. And for me, I just can't, I can't vote for an approval of this and potentially offend or even insult the other four presidents who have been here for decades. Thank you.
Vice Chair Goodman.
Thank you. I just would like to make a point with all due respect, Regent Arascata, as well, and I can understand where you're coming from. I do think what we need to really look at is what that pay scale is. I don't believe that is Dr. Lopez Lassiter's problem that you know, we have a $430,000 to $735,000 range for the president of Nevada State University. What we need to do is we need to go back and we need to look at that and find out, is this salary appropriate for that university? You know, we've got presidents that are doing incredible work making significantly less with significantly more students. And so I do think that the recommendation of the chancellor to go at the very lowest of this range is all we can do right now. And then moving forward, we need to really assess what that salary range is for that institution. So I can appreciate where you're coming from, Regent Arascata. At the same time, I feel like we are in a space that this isn't Dr. Lopez Lassiter's problem, that our pay range for that institution is significantly robust.
Regent Brown.
Well stated. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Brown, for the record, I want to echo what my colleague, Regent Goodman, just said. I also want to point out the fact that this is, I mean, we've all asked for a national search. That's what we voted on in the last meeting. And I think this is the first steps towards that. So anybody who will be applying for this job will also be looking at this meeting and the conversations that we have. And if we're saying that we're not valuing this position, even though this is, you know, I just think we're setting a bad precedent. So I think the chancellor and, you know, picking the lower end of the scale was the right thing to do. I also think that we've had this exact same conversation when it came to positions with our chief of staff, right? We've had this conversation. And the same people that are saying that this isn't right, we're stood on the other side of that. So continuity, where we're at, how we're moving forward, it's important that we realize that they're paying attention from this moment and every moment past and moving forward. So I will support what was written and presented to this in this document for Dr. Lopez Lassiter.
Regent Gokachia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, compensation clearly is an issue, and I agree whether we're talking grad students or whether we're talking president salaries. And we need to address it as a board, and being one of the three newbies on, or four newbies, I guess, on the board, we can always plead a little ignorance in, well, we weren't part of it and we're trying to figure it out. But the bottom line is we clearly need to deal with the compensation. But in this case, it was the lowest of the base pay. The chancellor did what he had to do, and we need to move forward with it. But that said, I think this board has to be committed to taking a look at what our compensation is from top to bottom. Thank you.
I don't see any other regents with questions or comments. I believe this, the approval for the proposed employment agreement, that motion came from Regent Brager. It was seconded by Regent Brown. And I'll ask our Chief of Staff, Karen Nikolajewski, to take a roll call vote.
Regent Bautista. Yes. Regent Boylan.
I'll abstain again. Thank you.
Regent Brager.
Yes.
Chair Brooks.
Yeah. Yes.
Regent Brown.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho.
Yes.
Regent Del Carlo.
Yes.
Regent Downs.
Yes.
Regent Fernandez.
Yes.
Regent Goicoechea. Yes. Vice Chair Goodman.
Yes.
Regent McGrath.
Yes.
Regent Arascada.
No.
The motion passes.
Thank you. Congratulations, Dr. Lassiter. What I'd like to do is take a 5-minute administrative break just so you can get your congratulatory kudos from colleagues. All right, so we'll move on to agenda item number 3. This is the commencement of a search for permanent president at NSU, and we can take all of this. Really, what I'd like to do is just open it up for if there's regents that have any questions about how we can get this done. Certainly input from the chancellor in terms of what this looks like. In fact, if there's anything that you'd like to lead us off with regarding the search.
Thank you, Chair. I would gladly work with Chief of Staff Nikolajewski moving forward. I think you heard that the campus really wants a national search and a reputable search firm and to start immediately. I think those are the right recommendations, and I suggest that we proceed as soon as possible, working with Chief of Staff Nikolajewski to select a firm, get an RFP out, and get moving.
Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's appropriate, I'd like to make a motion to commence a search immediately for a permanent president and to conduct a national search with the services of a search consultant to assist the president's search committee and also a search consultant that is experienced in higher education.
Motion. Second.
Where did the second come from?
He can have it.
Regent Downs,
thank you very much. So we have a motion by Regent Carvalho to immediately start a search for president at NSU. That search will be a national search, and we will use a search consultant that has experience in higher education. Is there any other discussion for this agenda item? We'll just take a voice vote. Those who are in favor, please signify by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Those who oppose, please signify by saying no or nay. That motion passes. We'll move on now to agenda item number 4. This is an honorary degree agenda item, and I'll ask President Heavey to speak on this agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. Chris Heavey, for the record. Delighted to be here today to ask for an honorary degree for Mr. Edward Smith. Mr. Smith is a man who began of modest means, but through hard work and perseverance became a successful businessman who believed in paying it forward and has focused on the field of nursing with over $2 million in contributions to support more than 300 scholarships for aspiring nurses. And we would like to honor Mr. Smith in the late years of his life for his contributions to the university and the community through this philanthropy with an honorary degree. Ask for your approval. Thank you.
Thank you, President Heavey. I'd like to open up for discussion or a motion. Vice Chair Goodman.
I move to approve.
Seconded.
Perfect. So we have a motion by Vice Chair Goodman to approve, seconded by Regent Boylan. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, we'll go for a just a quick voice vote. Those who are in favor, please signify by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
Those who oppose, please signify by saying no or nay. That motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Heavey. We'll move on to agenda item number 5. This is a graduate faculty and staff housing project up at UNR, and I'll ask President Sandoval to speak on this agenda item.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the Board of Regents, Chancellor, for the record, Brian Sandoval, President of the University of Nevada. I appreciate the opportunity to provide an update on the university's ongoing efforts to expand adjacent high-quality housing options for our graduate students, faculty, and staff. As the Board is aware, the university has made meaningful progress in recent years through the development of Ponderosa Village and the acquisition of University Village. These important steps have significantly strengthened our housing portfolio and enhanced options for our students, faculty, and staff. At the same time, continued growth in our campus community underscores the importance of expanding the range of more affordable and convenient housing opportunities near our campus. The project before you today, located at 600 University Way, represents the next phase in meeting this goal. The development will include approximately 400 units, consisting primarily of studios, one-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments, complemented by modern amenities designed to support both academic success and community engagement. Importantly, this project will be financially self-sustaining and independent, and the university will make no direct investment. I think that's really important for all of you to know. It will be developed in partnership with a nonprofit entity using tax-exempt revenue bonds with ownership of both the land and improvements transferring to the university upon retirement of the debt. And again, I think that's a really important factor for you all to understand, approximately within 30 to 40 or so years. The partnership structure also enables the university to advance the project without land acquisition costs, as the proposed developer, Scenic Investments, already owns the property. This presents a timely and strategic opportunity to expand affordable housing adjacent to campus while conserving university resources. Operationally, the property will be managed by Redstone Residential, one of the nation's largest and most experienced student housing operators, ensuring professional management, strong resident engagement, and a supportive living environment. Beyond addressing an immediate housing need, the project advances the university's long-term vision of developing a university village, an integrated academic and residential community that enhances student success, faculty and staff recruitment, and overall vibrancy of our campus. It also directly aligns with the NSHE strategic plan, promoting access and success by strengthening our ability to attract and retain exceptional students, faculty, and staff. I want to emphasize that today's presentation is for information only. We plan to return to the December Board of Regents meeting to seek approval to move forward with this project. So in sum, this project is more than a housing development. It is a strategic investment in the people who make the University of Nevada thrive. It strengthens our campus footprint. It supports institutional growth and lays the foundation for a vibrant, sustainable future. And again, to orient you all, you see the picture up on the screen. The University Village is directly south of main campus and immediately adjacent to University Village. So it's within a block away of the university. It's near the bus line. The other thing I wanted to emphasize is if you look in the materials, that it is the very low end of range with regard to the rents for the proximate, the other apartments and such in the area. And it also will add inventory to a really tight market because, again, as you will see, the vacancy rate for adjacent properties within 3 miles is between 2 and 5%. So with that, Mr. Chair, I am happy to respond to any questions that you or any members of the Regents have. Thank you.
Thank you, President Sandoval. Are there any questions by Regents?
Yes, from Regent McGrath.
Go ahead, Regent McGrath.
Thank you so much for this, President Sandoval. Wonderful presentation. It looks like a beautiful project. I know we all do appreciate that there's no direct cost. I wanted to ask, I know that Redstone Residential certainly has a tremendous track record in management of collegial residential housing. I did want to focus a little on the public comment that we received, because I had the same question when I looked at the materials. Do you know whether there can be any role played by the university if rents are raised at a later point, or those are viewed to be, you know, too high or maybe cost prohibitive for students? Is that something that we cede control of, or is that something that could be addressed at any point in the future?
Mr. Chair, to you and through you to Regent McGrath. So I appreciate the question. First, with regard to rents, we have within the negotiation a provision that would limit any type of rent increase to 3% per year as we move forward in the future. I think another component that I think is meaningful is that we actually will have input with regard to the design and what is in within that building, and that, you know, just like anything else, the cost of that building will have a direct relationship to what the cost of the rents are going to be. So we will have input in that. And I'm sure you appreciate, Regent McGrath, it's not our project, but at the same time it is. So we have had, we're going to have direct input with regard to the design and other matters associated with the project. You know, one of the things, you know, that you have to balance is the market, and many of the students would like to have the amenities. So you will see in this project, there's a swimming pool and other things that they would like to have, and there's a cost associated with that. So we really do want to balance, you know, making sure that this is a place that students are going to thrive and want to live there. But at the same time, not limit it so that nobody wants to go there, because that product or project will not be competitive with others with regard to the amenities that are offered. I guess last thing I'll say, as you say, it's studios, one bedrooms and two bedrooms. Unlike some of the other projects, they will have one entryway with four bedrooms with a shared common area. This will not have that. And so those others, they can charge lesser rents for that, but the graduate students, early faculty, early staff, I think would prefer not to have that communal living. I'm looking at the chair and she's nodding. So these are all things that inform this design, but you know, believe me, we are very aware of the high cost of housing in Reno, and we want to make sure that it is as affordable as possible for everyone. But these are all some of the elements that we have to balance as we go into this. But even with those amenities, it will be, at least as we stand here today, at the low end of rents for the competition. And you will see there's an extensive survey in the materials that are in front of you. I think they looked at over between 60 or 90 properties that were within a 3 mile radius. So thank you for the question, Regent.
No, thank you, President Sandoval. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Regent Borland.
Thank you, Chair. President Sandoval, or Mr. GQ himself out here, So is the rent the same for the students as well as for faculty? They all pay the same amount?
Chair Brooks, tweeting through you to Regent Boylan. And again, we're at an early phase of this,
yes, sir.
But the intent is regardless of the individual that is renting the unit, they will be charged the same. There won't be a distinction between a graduate student, a faculty member, or early staff.
And
so in other words, yeah, they won't charge a faculty member more because they're faculty.
Right, even though they make much more money than the students, hopefully. So is there any way that we can help students with that since they don't make as much money? Is there any other thing we can do with this new structure?
You know, we're having discussions. I don't want to have any spoiler alerts. I do have an idea, Regent Boylan, but I'm going to say it on Monday at the State of the University.
Uh-huh.
So for something to help with the graduate students. But, you know, we want to do everything we can. And, you know, in some portions in some of the colleges, we have increased the stipends for our graduate students. For example, in the College of Engineering, my understanding is there's been an increased stipend, and you know, we've heard this loud and clear, and we want to do everything we can for our graduate students. We value them and appreciate them and thank them for everything that they've done. But with regard to this project, again, it is different than Ponderosa Village on our campus. We own Ponderosa and we run it and we can control the rents, whereas this project will be owned independently of the university.
That's awesome. Thanks for the information, President Sandoval. If you remember, it's been 5 years since I've been on this board, and from I think the first year, I was asking about the stipends for graduate students. And it doesn't seem to have got much higher since 5 years ago. Am I right or wrong about that? A wee bit, but not much.
I'll use the wee bit.
Okay, all right.
Regent Boylan,
yes, sir.
There was, I believe it was in the 2023 legislative session, there was an increase in graduate student stipends that was approved by the legislature.
Right.
And again, we on our campus, we used to not cover the complete cost of tuition and fees. We now do that, and we also cover the medical insurance for our graduate students on our campus.
That's awesome. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Regent Gokachia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Sandoval, I just need to get it on the record. Okay, the university isn't managing it, but do you have to be enrolled and employed by UNR then to rent there?
Or you do not. Excuse me.
Will it be open to the public?
Yeah. Chair Brooks, to you and through you, to Regent Gokachia, it will be offered to our students, faculty, and staff first. So, and also the rules for at least undergraduate students and graduate students, our student housing rules will apply to them in that building in terms of management. I don't think we would do that with our faculty or staff. So there'll be a distinction in living areas. So we won't have faculty staff on the same, will not have faculty and staff on the same floors as undergraduate students or graduate students. It'll be available to graduate or undergraduate students as well. But can I stand here and tell you today that there won't be someone who's not enrolled or employed at the university? No, I can't say that. That who would live there?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I chime in on that? Please do.
Chair Brooks, Regents, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Vice President, Administration and Finance at the University of Nevada, Reno. just want to add on to what the President said. The affiliation agreement limits the occupants to grad students, medical students, and faculty and staff. If the occupancy doesn't hit 90%, then it opens up to graduate students. And the only addition outside of those currently enrolled is recent graduates of the university. So it is limited on who can live at the facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to stand to be corrected on that one. So,
Regent Carballo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a few questions for either Vice President Klinger or President Sandoval. I do see on the briefing paper that on page 2, it does say under development restrictions that the university cannot that you need to stay within the debt service coverage ratio of 1.2. And so I also realize that the rents that have been discussed so far are market rents and comps for the area. So I don't know if I am curious if looking at pro formas will you see that there might be lower rents based on that ratio or higher. I am just a little concerned about rents, although I know that there's potential softening of markets nationally, so I don't know if that's also going to be the case in Reno. I don't have that crystal ball, and I look forward to seeing some more financial information come before us, perhaps in at the December meeting or whenever this comes to us. But are you thinking at this point that your target rents are going to be close to what those market rents are in Danter's presentation?
Mr. Chairman, Regents, for the record, Andrew Klinger, Vice President of Administration. The answer is that the market study was a snapshot in time as of May of this year. And obviously rents change depending on obviously supply and demand. The other thing, and the president said it, is that the development costs have a direct impact on what the rents are going to be. And in the pre-development agreement, we have approval over the design of the product. And so we have a lot of input on what the product is going to be and what it's going to look like. And we will certainly, as we go through it, we will use affordability as a guiding principle as we look at design. Like the president said, there are offsets to that, right? There are certain amenities that maybe you don't put in the product or others that you do. And so those are things that we'll have to look at. So we don't have total development costs yet. We don't know what the total financing costs are going to be, but we will certainly have input on the design. The other thing that I will say is that through the affiliation agreement, we have the ability and we will be approving the budget of the product as it goes forward. So we will have eyes on the financial operations, if you will, to make sure that it's certainly within line with the rest of the market.
Thank you, and I appreciate that UNR has that ability to supervise this part of the project and to give input on the level of amenities and things like that. So that gives me comfort. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other regents with questions? Thank you very
comment
much.
Comment for Marita?
Comment.
Oh, sure.
I just have a comment. I just want to thank President Sandoval for your intentionality of finding housing. I know you tried very hard when we were going to go in the old Harrah's, and you had that really great reduced rent for the graduate students there, and that project didn't pencil out, and the developer had to pull it back. But you've never stopped since you've been the president looking out for the students and trying to find affordable housing and finding options. And the fact that there's no state money, no UNR money here, that those relationships with other creative ways to do it with other partners is really commendable. And I'm born and raised in Reno. Who'd ever thought we'd be in such a housing crisis? But it's true, really, a lot of places, especially in my community up in Incline Village, people can't afford to live there at all. But I really thank you for being so intentional and watching out for not only the students, but the faculty and staff too, because they also need a nice, decent place to live in. I think the students do want nicer amenities and are willing to pay a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent DelCarlo.
Like my fellow regents to the right, I too am born and raised in Reno, as are a lot of people here on this dais today. But at one point, there were statements that there's going to be an oversaturation of housing options up near the University of Nevada, with the influx of private builders constructing large apartment complexes. That's not true, and that's not true at all. The demand for affordable housing is identified beginning on page 33 through 42 of our briefing material. With very few exceptions, as I look at it, the majority of the apartments constructed in or around, or at least in the vicinity of the university, over the past 20 years, have a 90% occupancy rate. And there are four subsequent pages identify the rate of return, which is the collective monthly rent of this investment. I mean, this is extremely impressive research you all have done. But I want to emphasize on page 13 and 14 of reference material 5B, the university strategically placed itself with the heavy hitters. Again, you have a national construction company, or excuse me, a national developer that's going to be coming in, and they're facing the business with pragmatic approaches to financing. Compliments to the developers, the university, Redstone Residential, the National Campus Community Development. This is the university continues to step it up, primarily for the graduate students and the faculty and the staff. Well done.
Thank you, Regent Arascata.
Well, thank you, President Sandoval, and thank you very much for your participation in the presentation today. I was going to move to agenda item number 6, but lunch is here, so we'll take a few minutes to grab something to eat, and we'll come back and move on to the next agenda item. Thank you. Okay. I hope everyone had a great lunch. We're going to get moving on our next agenda item. What I'm going to do is, just for the sake of time and consideration for our UNLV athletic director who's got to travel and ensure another win out of state, we're going to move agenda item number 7 up. And so we will move into our conversation in education about name, image, and likeness, and its involving impact on collective athletics. And to do that, I'd like to introduce Bill Carter, who is a subject matter expert in NIL and a faculty member at both the University of Vermont and Boston College. And Bill is also the founder of Student Athlete Insights, and he will help us with understanding NIL. Bill, you want to take it away?
First of all, thanks so much for the invitation to join you all today, and really looking forward to this. And we're going to just really just jump right in. Sorry ahead of time, I don't have control of the slides, so you're going to hear me say for the first time and for about 40 more times. Let's go ahead and move on to the next slide. So quick introduction. I've spent about 25 years in the sports industry, mainly on the professional sports side, and mainly working with Fortune 500 brands on their athlete marketing plans. In about 2019, when we recognized that NIL was going to become a reality, I sort of shifted to the college athletic space and began to apply what I understood about athlete marketing as well as regulations and policies around collegiate athletics that were unfolding. So today I work for about 30 Division I universities, as well as a number of brands, as well as some high school athletic associations. And as been mentioned, I teach NIL at the business schools at both the University of Vermont, I live in Burlington, Vermont, and at Boston College. Let's move on. So today what we're going to cover are really sort of 5 key areas, a little bit of laying the foundation, the groundwork for NIL, We're going to spend some time discussing regulations. I want to describe what NIL looks like in practice, mainly at the collegiate level. We'll talk about some key NIL issues that are still unfolding. We're going to mention revenue sharing a bunch of times in this conversation, but things like NIL for international athletes or impact on women's sports and Title IX. And then we're going to wrap up with some short information around NIL and the future. Feel free if you are logging in and watching remote and you want to ask a question, go ahead and use the raise your hand feature. Unfortunately, I don't have a view right now of those of you who are live in that room. I can only see my slides. We're certainly going to have more than enough time at the end of the presentation to have a discussion, and I'm happy to answer any and all questions then as well. So next slide. So let's start with NIL foundations. Next. So the first thing I'd like to describe in laying the groundwork for NIL is that it's important for you to begin to see NIL not as a set of rules or policy changes, but really a development of a new industry or a new ecosystem. And so I mentioned what we're going to cover today. It's most of what is on this slide, but sort of in summary, there are the regulations, the institutions, the student athletes and the activities they're doing. There are things called NIL collectives and clubs, which have sort of morphed more or less into the same thing, but I want to make a sort of comment on how those things are a little bit different out there in the real world. We're going to talk about NIL marketplaces, the impact of NIL on service providers like financial advisors, those who sell insurance, agents, attorneys, and others. We're going to talk a little bit about what some larger brands are doing in the NIL space and why they're doing it. And then I want to mention really sort of as a resource to you, some media that are worth following. Next. So just to sort of set us in the right direction, the true definition of NIL is in reference to the right of publicity, the right of individuals to control and profit from their from the commercial use of their identity. Notice in this definition, there's nowhere it says athletic department. Nowhere does it say student athlete. Nowhere does it say college athletics. And the reason is that NIL is actually not a new concept. From a state law perspective, and it's on the books in about 40 state laws, I believe, and then the others, obviously, it's a commonly accepted practice that you control your own identity for commercial purposes. But really, from a state law perspective, it's been around for about 100 years. And so when we think about NIL in the college context, the college athletics context, that's really the only place it's new, and it's only new there because that was a segment of the population, call it 500,000 college student athletes across the country, who were prohibited from participating in a state's right that all of the rest of us had been granted and maybe had been exercising. Next. So in furtherance of the definition of NIL, I like to also describe NIL sort of in three parts, all of which those of you who follow college athletics probably have read something about. And we now sort of, for better or for worse, we now sort of include all of these items as part of NIL, when in fact, really, one of them is not part of NIL at all, but I sort of need to define it this way. So really true, genuine NIL is this first thing on the left called brand partnerships, right? So this is the relationship between a private business or a public company It could be any sort of brand. It could be a small local cafe that's located a mile off of campus. It could be Gatorade in Chicago, right? They're both brands, and from an NIL perspective, they both operate the same way, in which they are developing a partnership with a student athlete. The second kind of NIL is sort of collective NIL, and you've probably heard the term NIL collective. We're going to talk about this in more detail in a few minutes, but for now, I'll just tell you that an NIL collective is typically a third party. It's not part of the athletic department. It's a third party entity, mostly for profit businesses. Some have been registered as nonprofits. We'll talk about that in a few minutes too. But 99 out of 100 times, they've been developed by boosters or alums of that university that they're trying to support. But they're not part of the athletic department. They are third parties. And then last but not least, and we'll spend some time talking about this throughout today's presentation, there's revenue sharing. Now, revenue sharing is not really part of NIL, right? It's part of the NIL discussion we're having, but there's no NIL relationship between a university and a student athlete, which is really tied into revenue sharing. Now, there can be, but in most instances, there's not. Revenue sharing is the direct payment from the university to a student athlete as part of what's called the house settlement. And we're going to talk about that on the next slide right now. The house settlement, which has been in the news practically daily over the last 3 months, and you've probably heard about it, the house settlement is the result of a class action lawsuit from Grant House, who's a swimmer at Arizona State, and others, versus the NCAA, and at the time, what was called the Power Five, really now what many are referring to as the Power Four, but the SEC, the Big Ten, the ACC, the Big 12, and the Pac-12. And ultimately, and I'm sort of going to skip to the punchline of the story, ultimately, the house settlement plays out with these results, that those conferences are required to share revenue with their student athletes. And there's a couple of really key components for all of you to know. The cap on that revenue share is $20.5 million. Not all institutions that have opted into this settlement, Division II and Division III, this is not relevant. Division I institutions had the choice whether to opt into the settlement, except for whether they were part of one of those conferences. Those conferences were required. All of the other conferences had the choice of whether to opt in. If they opted in, they were not required to share revenue of $20.5 million. They could share as much or as little revenue as they wanted up to that cap of $20.5 million. There's a backward-facing component, which we're not going to really get into any detail, but that $2.8 billion is being distributed for athletes who were on rosters between 2016 and today. And then there's one other thing that's really important to know about the house settlement, which is around scholarships and rosters. So one of the things that was eliminated in the house settlement were scholarship limits. So many of you are probably big football and basketball fans. Well, most everybody on, other than the walk-ons, most everybody on a football roster, Division I level, is on a full scholarship. Everybody who's playing Division I men's or women's basketball has a full scholarship. But before the house settlement, there were lots and lots of teams that had scholarship limits. So they could have 45 athletes on a team. I'll use a sport that's outside of your state on purpose. So men's lacrosse probably carried 55 players last year on most rosters, but their scholarship limit was about 14. So they were sharing a lot of those scholarships across probably 25 or 30 players, and were players who weren't getting anything. But there was no roster limit. They could have 100 players if they chose to, but they just wouldn't do that for practice and other reasons. Now, scholarship limits have been removed. So that same men's lacrosse team, if the school wants to fund it, they can go to 45 scholarships. Now, most won't, because they won't have the ability to do that. They won't have the resources to do it. But what the NCAA has done, what the House settlement has done, is put roster limits. So that roster men's lacrosse at Dartmouth College, actually, that's a bad choice, University of Virginia, probably had 55 guys last year. This year, that limit is 45. But if Virginia chooses, they can give every single one of those athletes a full scholarship. So it's been a real trade-off. Next. So quick comment on what NIL is not. It's not a salary for playing a sport. It doesn't make a student athlete an employee of the university. So even though the university is quite literally writing a check to the student athlete because of this new relationship they have as a result of the House settlement, they are not an employee of the institution. We're not going to talk a lot about that tonight, today, but I will tell you that is the next great fight that will need to play out most likely in the courts, whether we make student athletes employees or not. And of course, universities and the NCAA do not want that to happen. I don't think athletes have much of an opinion because they're not very well informed, but there are those that are very forceful in their will to push for that to happen, to have student athletes become employees. And tied to what I was just saying about roster limits and scholarships, NIL does not replace scholarships. Next. So two other quick sort of misconceptions around compensation. Of course, news cover the biggest deals, the shiniest objects, the most sort of over the top stories, right? Those are where it get our attention. And typically what that means in coverage of NIL is that you're seeing deals that talk about, you know, quarterbacks in the SEC, point guards, six or even seven figure deals. And so we've grown accustomed to believing that that's what NIL is, when in fact that is quite literally represents about 1% of all NIL activity. The rank and file of student athletes across the country are doing hundreds of NIL deals are happening a month. Thousands and thousands of NIL deals are happening over the course of a year. And most of those deals are very, very small. They are $60 between a local brand or local business and a track and field athlete to post on social media. And in exchange for that promotion, that athlete gets paid $60 or $100 from that cafe, right? That's really what it looks like. And if you want to dig into the detail here and you want a resource for this, you're going to have this presentation. Click through the link here where I've linked NCAA's data dashboard. That dashboard allows you to see in aggregate form the size, or rather the lack of size, of most NIL activity. Lastly, on this page, NIL is not and should not be pay to play. It's the genuine NIL piece is the relationship between a brand or a business to an individual student athlete. It's really not about collectives, and it's really not about revenue sharing. Next. So in terms of the market overall, now that I've sort of told you this, you know, on one end of the spectrum, these transactions tend to be very small. When you do look at the NIL market across the board in all forms, again, brand partnerships, collective deals, and revenue sharing, when you group that together, it's a sizable and growing market. So where we started in 2021 for those first 12 months, it was, you know, close to a $1 billion market, but now we're closing in, close to 2 billion. It will be 2 billion by the end of this year, and projected in 26 to be, you know, probably 30% higher than that. Next. So the other thing, I think it's important to sort of recognize, you're in a unique state in many ways. But one of the things that is unique about your state is that you have an NIL state law. You permit high school NIL, and you've got, UNLV and Nevada are high profile athletic programs, right? And so, there's probably in your state even greater support because of that environment that you live in, even greater support than we see for NIL across the country. But across the country, NIL is widely supported, right? Almost 60% of Americans think that college athletes ought to be paid. More than 50% of Americans think that high school athletes should be permitted to participate, and they can participate in your state. And 40% of Americans think that it should be an opportunity available to youth athletes. And you can say, well, gosh, you know, that's still under 50%. Well, I'd say this. That 40% number in terms of youth participation is still higher than where college and high school were 5 years ago. So this is sort of, you know, in today's America, this shows like real support for NIL. Next. So the next area I want to get into is talking about regulations. So let's jump right into the next slide. So there's this term that's often sort of cast around in NIL, describing NIL as the Wild West. And it's a phrase that that I really don't like. And the reason I don't like it is that it's, to some, it means that there are no regulations, that there's sort of nobody at the helm of the ship. I'll give you the fact that NIL is chaotic. And if you mean it's the Wild West because it's chaotic, I believe that you're correct. But there's lots of places to go and find regulations, and we're going to talk about a few of them in the next few minutes. But all of these entities have a role in regulating NIL, from the governing bodies like the NCAA and also NAIA and Junior College, National Junior College Athletic Association, the new College Sports Commission. I mentioned state laws, high school associations. There's a lot of talk about the federal government, that there's no federal NIL law. And that's true. There is no federal NIL law. But the federal government's been involved in NIL at the agency level for several years already. And I want to make that sort of known in a few minutes with some detail. And then, of course, every university has their own policy related to NIL and compliance and so forth. Okay, next. So we're going to just touch on a couple of these briefly and what their role is. I'm going to move through these quickly. So the NCAA sets the overarching guidelines. The NCAA, as many of you know, is a membership institution. There are about 350 Division I institutions that are members of the NCAA, and the NCAA sets the guidelines. They're agreed on by those member institutions, and then those schools are obligated to follow those policies. Next. So you may or may not be familiar with something that's transpired over the last couple of months, really since the end of July. Some of this, I think, is sort of under the radar for most college sports fans, but really important for your group to know about. So there's been a new entity created coming out of the House settlement that I described earlier called the College Sports Commission. And the College Sports Commission, their role is to ensure that that revenue sharing piece and genuine NIL activities and activities as described by or done by NIL collectives are following the guidelines and the rules as have been established coming out of the House settlement. So most of the public doesn't know this name, College Sports Commission. Those who do are probably more familiar with another name called NIL Go. So NIL Go is operated by the College Sports Commission, and it's a public-facing sort of front door for the compliance of all of this that's on in front of you, right? So what happens is the member schools, that the Division I member schools, all of whom have a compliance office, are collecting the information relative to the NIL activity of their student athletes. And the College Sports Commission has access to that. And each individual student athlete is required to submit information, and they have help by their university, submit information about their NIL transactions. And so then those NIL transactions are, ahead of time, going to be approved, denied, or sometimes more information is requested by the College Sports Commission. Again, this is going through the front door, I'm using that phrasing, the front door of the College Sports Commission called NIL Go. It's where it's submitted, and then it's being approved, denied, or there's a request for more information. Next. So at the state level, there's actually not been a lot of new information in terms of NIL state law. Most of the states that have an NIL law pass them, you know, relatively quickly. Some have, you know, been a little bit slower. I think I looked in your state, yours was actually passed in 2021. And so there's not been a lot of movement, but again, important for you to know that there are in fact state laws relative to NIL. Next. So I mentioned before that while there's no NIL federal NIL law, and there's certainly there are two laws that are, you know, moving their way through the federal government now and under review, and we'll see how far they get. I still don't have much hope that either one of those bills will be passed and signed off on. But I do want to say that the federal government does in fact have a role right now in NIL, and I'll point to just three scenarios. The first is that the Federal Trade Commission is responsible, as many of you know, for the guidelines for all advertising and marketing in this country, including social media influencer marketing. And 85% of all NIL activity, all NIL transactions are connected to social media. they are, in fact, similar to that example I gave 10 minutes ago when I said that a student athlete's been hired by a local business to post on their social media about that cafe in exchange for compensation. Well, what that student athlete does really is guided by the guidelines set in place by the FTC. So in a lot of the teaching that I do of student athletes, a lot of it actually is focused on helping student athletes abide by the FTC guidelines. So that's the first place the government is already involved, federal government's already involved. Second is the IRS. So the IRS has gotten involved in a couple of things, but the main most notable one is that there are about 200, maybe 225 NIL collectives, connected to universities at the Division I level right now. Probably between 30 or 40 of them were initially created as nonprofits. And the thinking was that if we created an NIL collective nonprofit, then when an alumnus gave money to that collective, they could enjoy the tax benefit of that. Well, the IRS, walked into this maybe a year and a half ago and said, no, there's no tax exempt sort of benefit, no activity going on that aligns with how these rules have been established. So what the IRS said to those particular collectives was, you can call yourself a nonprofit, but we're not going to treat you and provide you those benefits, nor anybody who gives you money. Now, this was in some ways music to the ears of the actual athletic departments associated with those collectives, because of course universities are nonprofits, and donations to a university does see the tax benefit. So again, IRS already involved. They're involved in some other things, but that's the most notable one. Third is the State Department. So the State Department is ultimately the body that determines the landscape of international students. Forget student athletes for a moment. International students at campuses across the country. So most student athletes are here studying on what's called an F1 visa. And with an F1 visa, that student athlete, or a student, if it was just somebody who is not participating in college athletics, they have a very, very small sort of set of parameters that they need to stay within in order to do any work while they're here in the U.S. as a student. So they have to do that work on campus. It has to be relative to their major. I mean, there's some other things to it, but those are the big ones that essentially disqualify international athletes from participating in NIL. Now, there are now some workarounds that are being tested, but in general, because of these existing State Department rules, it's been very difficult, some would say impossible, for international student athletes to have participated in NIL. Next. So one of the last things I want to touch on in terms of the sort of regulation piece is what's happening at the high school level. So there are roughly 51 independent associations. There might actually be a few more than 51 because there are a few states that have more than one association. North Carolina, for instance, has an association for public schools, has a different association for private schools. But you often hear from the NFHS, which is sort of the over, the membership organization of high school athletics. They're really not setting the policy at the state level. They came out early in terms of, what their belief system was in terms of NIL, and then the individual state associations all now set their own policies. As of today, there are 43 states that permit NIL at the high school level. And I would suspect We will be at 51. I get to 51 because of Washington, D.C., of course. I suspect we will be at 51 by the end of 2026. Next. Okay. So next, I want to talk about NIL in practice. What some of it looks like out there in the real world. Next. So I mentioned the importance of social media a few minutes ago, and so I operate a poll that includes 5,000 current college student athletes and 1,000 high school prospects. It's called the NIL Research Poll. I've operated it since probably the fall of 2021. And about once a quarter, I collect information from student athletes around NIL activity that they're currently doing. And these numbers have now become very stable. The last, say, 18 months, there's been almost no movement. So in terms of that genuine NIL brand partnership piece, the way it plays out is that 85% of those deals are related to social media. They are a brand partnering with a student athlete for that student athlete to perform social media influencer activities. It doesn't make the rest of these activities meaningless, but I say this from the standpoint of when you go onto a campus and you are trying to educate student athletes about NIL and how they can participate, it really needs to start with all things social media. How to develop a social media presence, how to do outreach to brands and businesses, how to really be a solid social media influencer, right? Because 85% of the opportunities are there. Autographs, licensing deals, selling merchandise, doing appearances, all those sorts of things. They're opportunities. They're mainly opportunities for football and basketball athletes. I'd say the one exception here that actually where there I am still seeing growth is in the area of instruction, which typically includes camps, clinics, or private instruction, all done and being operated by the student athletes. Okay, this is particularly great for student athletes in sports where you're like golf or tennis. Ones where that sort of one-on-one instruction is sort of built into the sports culture, if you will. Next. When you look at where the distribution of activities are across the sports, you know, it's funny. When I show this slide to people, it's like, I guess whatever your perspective is what you want to see in this slide. You know, I'm a pretty optimistic guy. I don't allow my focus to be entirely about football. And when I look at this slide, I say, this is actually great news. This is 60% of all NIL transactions are happening outside of football. And I think if you want to see the world through exclusively a football lens, you'll see just the opposite. And you'll just see how dominant football is. There's no question football is king, and it's probably never going to change in our lifetime. But I will say that there are athletes in pretty much all 20-plus NCAA Division I sports that are participating in NIL activities. Next. So in terms of the actual student-athlete engagement, in other words, how many student-athletes are actually doing something connected to NIL, at the Division I level, if you include all three kinds of NIL that I described earlier, if we're going to allow ourselves to define it that way, partnerships, collectives, and revenue sharing, it's close to 40% on most D1 campuses. That's not all. I live almost across the street from the University of Vermont. I'll tell you that number at University of Vermont is probably in the teens, 15 or 16%. And of course, at the University of Alabama, it's probably well over 40%. So 40% is sort of that median number. What's happening in the high school space? I only bring this up because it's really about access. So only about 1% of high school athletes are participating in NIL. And, you know, first of all, that's okay. There are 8 million high school athletes in this country. Only 500,000 of the 8 million today will go on to play NCAA Division I, II, or III. Only 200,000 of those 8 million today are going to go on to play Division I athletics. So these numbers are actually fine. But I'll tell you this. One of the big changes you're going to see in high school NIL is that that 1% number is going to increase significantly in the coming years when those student athletes have marketplaces, which I'm going to describe in a few minutes, and other opportunities that allow them much easier access to NIL opportunities. Next. So I want to jump back to what's sort of happening on the ground at most campuses. So I said 40% of student athletes on a lot of Division I campuses are participating. So then, therefore, what is the role of the university? And it's up to the university what to prioritize. I can tell you from my experience in operating with about 30 schools right now, most schools see NIL and their obligation as educators and supportive of student athletes is to do the following. One, they want to build infrastructure. And oftentimes this means developing a relationship in which they are paying for an NIL marketplace or exchange. So some of the brand names there are Open Doors, Influencer, Mogul. We're going to talk more about marketplaces in a few minutes. But it is the university's, not responsibility, but I think many see it as their responsibility to have a relationship with an NIL marketplace that does provide access to opportunities for student athletes. Second, while collectives are third-party entities, most universities see it as their role to be connected to that NIL, to be supportive of that NIL, even going as far as asking their alumni to donate to the NIL. I'm sorry, donate to the collective. Third, which is absolutely an obligation, is the whole piece around compliance, to track the NIL activity of their student athletes and to provide that information to the NCAA or the College Sports Commission. And then last but not least, sort of where I make my living most of the time, which is in educating student athletes. So I would say of 350 Division I schools, I would say 250, maybe 275 have committed to some type of NIL education. I think if you're at the bottom of Division I and you may feel like you have some responsibility, but you can also probably talk yourself into thinking that you don't have a lot of student athletes or that all that interested. I think that's probably not correct. And we'll see. I think at some point, probably close to all 350 Division I schools will have some educational element in place. Next. So I've mentioned NIL collectives a bunch, so we're not going to stop here much longer other than to say, you know, the real sort of the definition of NIL as the NCAA of a collective, as the NCAA would describe it, a non-institutional entity. It's made up of boosters that assist student athletes in monetizing their name, image, and likeness. So the one thing I've sort of left out, and I'm going to describe very briefly here is, so then how does an NIL collective operate? Well, how they operate depends on the time frame you're looking at. prior to this last July, how they could operate was simply asking supporters for money, right, for $100 a month or to make a large donation. And then they would take that amount of money and essentially provide it directly to student athletes. Now, they were supposed to be, the student athletes were supposed to be providing some quid pro quo, some business relationship in exchange for that money. And some of that was happening and some of it wasn't. There was not a lot of oversight to it. But where we are today, now we're, you know, several months past this past July when the House settlement came down, where we are today is that the collectives are needing to operate differently. So they can still collect money from donors of all sizes, right? But now they've really got to operate like a sports marketing agency. So they might have, you know, $100,000 that somebody just gave them, a booster just gave them, and they want to distribute that $100,000 to the women's basketball team at the university that they support. But now that collective needs to go out and they've got to find another party, a brand, or more likely a nonprofit. And they'll say to the nonprofit, how about we get the, you know, 14 players from the women's basketball team to do social media on behalf of the, you know, your nonprofit, and we'll pay their tab. We'll pay each one of them, you know, $100,000 divided by 14, and they're all going to do 5 social media posts for you over the course of the season. So they're coordinating, orchestrating really the income and then also the distribution of those funds. It's messy now with collectives. And I'll sort of get to the, maybe one of the last things I'll say about collectives is that there's a lot of people that don't think collectives are going to be around much longer. And there's already a lot of evidence that some are folding, and we'll see. Some of them, some really strong ones, yay Alabama included as my example here, they seem to have found a path where they're going to make all this work, but I think there will be a lot of collectives that will be shut down. Next. So, I don't want to go too deep into the high school sport thing. I'm mentioning high school sports here only because obviously this is the ground from which these athletes then move on to play in college, right? And it's also sort of working the other way. So a lot of the regulations and rules and infrastructure that's been built for the college landscape has now filtered down to the high school landscape. I'll just say this, collectives are absolute no-go at the high school space. There's 100 reasons for that. But essentially, it would just be providing an unfair advantage, particularly to independent schools that might be able to set up an NIL collective and draw players in from public institutions. So 100% of the states that permit NIL activity at the high school, 100% of them still say collectives have no place in high school athletics and they are prohibited. Next. So I've mentioned NIL marketplaces. I mentioned it a few minutes ago when I was describing sort of the responsibilities as most athletic departments see it. So most Division I athletic departments have an established relationship at this point with one of the NIL marketplaces. Open Doors is the largest. Teamworks, which is a brand name, it's not really being used very much anymore. Well, Teamworks is the name it's being used. They own and operate a marketplace called Influencer. That's the brand name they're not using in public very much anymore. But essentially, these are marketplaces or exchanges. These are sort of the dating apps of NIL. On one side, you have student athletes who set up an account and describe who they are and what they do. And on the other side, local brands and local businesses and national businesses can set up accounts in the same system, and those two entities can find one another and participate in NIL partnerships together. Next. I wanted to mention in this section of how NIL is really operating out in the real world, I want to mention a little bit about professional service providers. So I've intentionally listed six on this page that I consider best in class. I'm going to talk about the darker side of this in the next slide. But on this slide, I just want to point out that agencies, financial advisors, attorneys, and others, I mentioned insurance providers, there is a whole sort of cottage industry being built around NIL in terms of professional service providers. So the big agencies, CAA, Wasserman, Excel, are treating NIL as simply business as usual, but in the way that they might not have approached a basketball or football athlete until maybe they were maybe a sophomore, freshman or sophomore, depending on the sport, in college. Now they're reaching out to those athletes at a much earlier age. As they feel like they have to develop the relationship throughout their entire college career, whether it lasts for 4 years or 1 year. So the process is just starting much earlier. I would say the same thing around the financial institutions. So in full disclosure, one of my clients is Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley is interested in NIL in the same way they've been interested for, not just interested, but they actually have the Morgan Stanley Sports and Entertainment Division located in the headquartered in New York, which works for professional athletes. Now they're beginning to work with more collegiate athletes. Most of them are on their way to the pros, but this has allowed Morgan Stanley and Merrill and Goldman Sachs to just sort of begin to work with younger and younger athletes. And then I've listed a couple of who I think are some of the really good attorneys along this in this third column. Next slide, please. So I want to say just for a moment, touch on sort of the sort of darker side of the professional services of folks and the industry that's being built. And I would say that it's the negativity is mainly around NIL agents. And I'm using that term on purpose. So where CAA or Wasserman or Excel that I just described on the previous page, they just describe themselves as agents like they always have. But there's a new kind of agent that's developed, and they are unregulated, not certified, no training, and they have just sort of gone on to LinkedIn and they've called themselves an NIL agent. And you know, like anything else, I guess, in this world, there's some people, you know, who are smart and they're trying to do a good job. And there are others who are neither of those things. So because there's no players union or association connected to college athletics in the way we have the NFLPA, Major League Baseball PA, NHLPA, remember, it's those players' associations that certify agents in those sports. But because we don't have that association, we don't have any association like that in college athletics, there's no certification available. And until there's a certification process, we're going to have this sort of very gray area, sometimes ugly part of athlete representation in college athletics. Next. So I want to talk just for a moment about brand involvement. And I want to, you know, particularly around the bigger brands. You know, every brand gets involved for NIL for a different reason, just like they participate in event sponsorship, athlete marketing, social media marketing, all those things, that they're determining what is going to, you know, get the most value for their limited ad dollars. But we see some really interesting use cases in NIL, right? And so they tend to fall into the areas of testing new markets, gaining a competitive advantage, or solving some other business or marketing problem, right? And so I'm not going to go through this list in detail, but I do want to touch on one interesting example down here on the right around drip drop. I would imagine that there are only probably a handful of you that even know what drip drop is, right? But drip drop is in the hydration category, and you all know Gatorade and Powerade. It would probably surprise you to know that drip drop is the hydration brand that's used at over 100 Division I schools, not necessarily on the sideline of the football game or basketball game, but in the locker room and in the training room. And so brands like Drip Drop see NIL as a way to demonstrate how NIL is really being used in the college athletic space, even though, of course, they have a fraction of the budget that, say, a Gatorade or a Powerade has. So these are some interesting use cases. I see these pretty frequently. Next. So I mentioned before, I'm not going to go through this list. I just wanted to give you this really as a resource, and you're going to have a copy of this document. If you're interested in following NIL, I would say don't use your Google News feed to serve you articles every week, because there's just so much out there that is, like not great information, not accurate information. And if anything, it sort of just feeds the cycle of like just retelling the story of the SEC quarterback who signed a $7 million deal or something. So I think the best sources are these four. Pete Nakos at a website called On3, Ross Dellinger at SI and writes for Yahoo. I think the best young reporter in NIL is a woman named Amanda Kristovich, who writes for Front Office Sports. Like, she's a must read every week. And then Ben Portnoy does an excellent job at Sports Business Journal. If you're on Twitter, I would follow all of them. And if you're looking for more, news, articles on a weekly basis, I would go to these four sources. Next. Okay. I want to just take our remaining few minutes and talk about some of the key issues that are still unfolding in NIL. And I'm going to describe what they are, but I, of course, don't have the final verdict and can't really even guess where we're headed. But I want to make sure that they're front and center for you, and that you know that they're still key issues. So let's go to the next page. So the first one is one we could spend another hour on, which is women athletes in NIL. And so the first thing I want to say is that it's one of the great myths and really a real disservice to women student athletes for us to perpetuate this narrative that NIL has been great for women athletes. It just hasn't. The numbers do not bear that out. So there's all kinds of evidence we can point to, but I'll just use one. Okay. So there's a ranking of the top 100 NIL athletes done by On3. It's based on evaluation system of, their social media visibility, the brands they already represent, so forth. It's the top 100. You can look at it almost any week of the year, and there will not be more than 3 women on that list. So 3% of the really high performing, high six figure mid-seven-figure student athletes, 3 out of 100 are women. That doesn't sound like, you know, NIL has been great for women. I think the most dangerous thing, though, is not just what's happened in the past, but this, the current climate in which the prior administration did not take any action, and the current administration is maybe even being slightly more forceful, going down the path that NIL income is not subject to Title IX enforcement. Again, we could talk about this for an hour, and I really try to not take sides on many of these issues, but I'll say that this is a fight to come. It's already somewhat, I mean, there are some lawsuits that are current right now about this, but right now, the institutions do not have to apply Title IX to their involvement in NIL, unless they're providing sort of very specific, tangible support. So what I will say this, what I suggest to my Division I clients is that don't take any chances here. You need to track who's receiving NIL support, doing anything. Ensure, as a Division I institution, ensure that the education, promotion, and resources that you're providing are gender balanced. Don't take any chances. And then ultimately, as an institution, you need to avoid endorsing or directing donors to push money towards male athletes when you're not doing so towards female athletes. So again, much, much more to come here. More to come. All right, next slide. So the second thing, and I'm not gonna go into a lot of detail here because I think I just explained, you know, pretty in a detailed way where we are with student athletes. You know, again, this, we're not done here either. There is a bill circulating at the federal level that would provide access to the current student athletes to NIL opportunities. I don't see that being a priority at any time in the near future. And there are some smart attorneys around the country that are trying to work their way through different kinds of visas, different than that F1 visa, which most college students get from other countries to study here in the U.S., but using sort of specialty visas, much like pro athletes from, you know, a soccer player from Europe who comes and plays here in the U.S., something like that, that they might be able to apply. But we're not done here yet, and that's still something that needs to unfold. Next. And then I couldn't end this talk today without mentioning the NCAA transfer portal. And believe me, I'm not going to read all this content to you, but I think that what you all know if you're a college sports fan is that the transfer portal is still relatively messy, right? It's essentially providing a tool for current college student athletes to have unlimited free agency, right? And so as much as I actually am an advocate for player movement and player choice, I often point out the fact that, transferring is not a student athlete issue. About 30% of all college students transfer during their 4 years, 30%, right? So lots and lots of people transfer. We shouldn't treat student athletes differently than the general student body. We should allow them to transfer, but we do not have control of that today. And so we need to get tighter controls, because each institution will then be healthier. the experience of the student athlete will be healthier if they're not moving three or four times over the course of 5 years trying to chase NIL opportunities versus staying put and learning what it's like to be a teammate on that team, to work with the same coaches, to get the benefit of the institution's academic and other support mechanisms. So we're not out of the woods on the transfer portal. I suspect we'll not that there will be no more restrictions and controls for a year or more. Next. And this, I'm just going to move to sort of the very last slide here, the very last content slide, which is sort of final, my final predictions, if you will. I talked about collectives before. I think collectives, most collectives are probably going to find themselves out of business in the next 2 years. And the operations of collectives are probably going to be moved in-house at most Division I institutions. It's still going to be a little bit tricky, but I think we're going in that direction. I think that Title IX is the next great battleground that's going to be fought. There is no way that, you know, 100,000 Division I women's student athletes are going to continue to participate in a landscape in which they're receiving, you know, roughly, you know, 10% of the overall earnings. There are going to be much greater controls put on the transfer portal, or a new entity, new mechanism is going to be created. And I think the stories of the mid-majors, I mean, we haven't talked about today, but you know, this idea that the mid-majors are somehow the AAA of college athletics. And if you have a good year or two there and you're, you know, a good point guard in a mid-major, you're just going to get, you know, scooped up by some Power Four program. I'm not sure that we really know that yet. In fact, there's some early evidence that that's not actually the way it's happening. There's a lot of transfer movement, but we haven't actually seen that that the mid-majors have become ravaged by the higher power Division I power conferences. And then last but not least, again, I probably shouldn't have written this in such a negative way, but I think the College Sports Commission, they're off to a, I shouldn't have said terrible. They're off to a really, really rough start. And I'm not sure that they survive another 2 years. I think that they may get replaced again by another entity, and maybe a new sort of fresh start might be needed. Next. So I wanted to leave you with this. Feel free to text or email or call me at any time if you have questions about this presentation or anything that's happening at a campus that you just have a question about. Feel free to reach out to me. And with that, maybe I'll ask for the slides to be taken down so I can see the room, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Thank you, Bill. We appreciate the education you just provided us on the many facets of NIL and some of the complexities of it. Are there any regents here that have any questions for Bill? Regent Gokachia?
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. And clearly, NIL is what it is, but the transfer portal. And I think where we really got to tighten it up is the eligibility requirements. Clearly, you know, having these guys, you know, we had the two players out of Texas this week. You know, they dropped out. They're not even going to complete the year because they want to go into the transfer portal. Well, if they do that, then that they need to lose the year's eligibility. You know, we've got these 8-year seniors that still got 6 years of eligibility left. It's a problem. So I enjoyed your presentation, but we've got a lot of problems to solve there too, more than just the regents in Nevada. Thank you.
I think that's a great point, and I can tell you're a big, big college football fan because you even know about the timing of the transfer portal. And that timing of the portal is really one of the key issues that needs to be solved. I mean, that's what we need to, I mean, that thing needs to be moved and tightened up. And the fact, as you indicate, that you could step off your team now to save your own eligibility. By the way, you couldn't do that if you blew out your ACL. We're more than 25% through the season right now. So you could blow out your knee and not have any more eligibility for this year, but you can leave your program and get it for NIL purposes and get and keep your eligibility and go somewhere else. And that's just, that's not right. No one agrees to that.
Thank you. You know, again, we appreciate the presentation. Also, you know, with us and standing by for questions is our athletic director from UNOV, Eric Harper, and the athletic director from Nevada, Reno, Stephanie Rimp. In case there's any specific questions that Regents might have regarding the institutions themselves. So, A.D. Harper.
UNLV is doing great, but UNR needs more money. Okay.
Yeah. A.D. Harper, I do have one question regarding collectives. And thank you for hanging out with us.
Sure.
And I'll ask, the AD up in Reno the same question. But in terms of collectives on the campus, how many collectives are there?
Eric Harper, for the record, Director of Athletics, UNLV. One collective here with UNLV, and that is UNILV, Friends of UNLV. And that's just one collective since the beginning, and it's the only one that still operates at this current time.
Okay. Thank you. And I'd ask A.D. Ramp also up in Reno that same question about the collectives.
Hold it. Hi, this is Stephanie Ramp for the record. We do not have any collectives.
Is it the... can you share with us what that looks like in terms of funding specifically for, NIL then up in Reno?
So with NIL, it's with a third party that is a business, and they have a relationship directly with our student athletes, and those are the deals that are put through NIL Go that have been approved. An example would be the GSR has NIL deals with several of our men's and women's basketball players. And then we have revenue share that goes through the department.
Got it. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that that you are both here to help us and answer questions specific to the institutions. Bill, I think that's a wrap. Thanks a lot for your participation in this. And we certainly value your knowledge in everything NIL. Thank you.
Byron, thanks so much for having me, and good luck to everybody today. Thank you.
And with that, we'll move on to what would have been agenda item number 6, and this is a handbook revision for professional staff collective, the bargaining regulations, and I'll ask Chancellor McNair to address this one.
Chair Brooks, I need to make a statement.
Regent Downs, I apologize. Go ahead and make the statement.
First. Pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A, that 420, I hereby disclose I am an employee of WNC, a former member of the NFA, and subject to the collective bargaining agreement and policies. Through consultation with special counsel, I have been advised that because the independence of a judgment of a reasonable person would be materially affected by my situation, I will not vote on this matter and I will abstain.
Thank you, Regent Downs. Chancellor?
Thank you, Chair Brooks. Matt McNair, NC Chancellor, for the record. And pretty soon I'll turn it over to Deputy General Counsel Parker to answer any questions. We're moving this ahead again, and I wanted to thank the representatives from the Faculty Senates and the NFA for negotiating with us. I feel bad. I apologize for not pulling this off the agenda at the last meeting. It was a little premature. We had begun having those conversations, but they hadn't evolved enough so that we got where we needed to be. And I think, as you heard from the people in public comment, we've gotten where we need to be now. I think shared governance is working. We will continue working on that and our commitment to it. I just wanted to say that. And now I will recommend approval of this and leave it to Deputy General Counsel Parker to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chancellor. Are there any questions by Regents regarding this agenda item? If not, then I would ask for a motion to approve the item.
Susan Brager, approve the motion, item number 6, the handbook revision for professional staff collective bargaining regulations. I'll
second it. Thank you. So we have a motion by Regent Brager for the approval of the revisions to the Board of Regents handbooks. This is going to be Title 4, Chapter 4, Sections 5 through 7 and 9 through 10. And this is seconded by Regent Boylan. I don't think that there's any discussion on this, and so we'll just take a quick voice vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Those who oppose, please signify by saying no or nay. And that motion passes. Thank you. We'll now move on to agenda item number 8. This is the handbook revision for NC councils, and I'll go back to the chancellor for this one.
Matt McNair, NC chancellor, for the record. Real quick, I'll tell you what this is and what it's not. What it is an effort to clean up the code, and what it's not is an effort to minimize the importance of any of the issues that these councils have addressed in the past. These are all issues that come up nearly every day in a shared governance environment. I think every day since I've been here, we've talked about money, we've talked about safety, we've talked about diversity and inclusion. If we have specific needs, I can always set up a working group like I have for the registration fee conversation. We have a group working to make a specific recommendation. I have similarly spoken with the Idea Council, or what will hopefully be the Idea Council for only a few more minutes, about continuing to meet with them and having them put together specific recommendations about ways that we can talk about issues of diversity and inclusion that will get past a lot of the misunderstandings that have been created by, I think, years of conversations that have gone in different directions because labels and words and phrases now mean different things to different people. So I'm going to use that group. I'm going to continue using that group to talk about how we can more clearly define our values and our principles and lean into these issues in ways that doesn't attract unwanted attention and doesn't create misunderstanding. So for that reason, this is simply an effort to clean up the code.
Thank you, Chancellor. Are there any regents with questions regarding this agenda item? Oh, sorry, I didn't see. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. I agree that on the face of this, for policy streamlining, it makes sense. I 100% agree with that. My concern is that when this is happening at this time, where there's a lot of sensitivity around voices and who has a place at the table and who doesn't, I'm just a bit concerned about the timing of it. I had a conversation with you and I, like I said, on paper and in theory, it makes a lot of sense to me. I just worry that I want to be sure that the voices that we have elevated and the places that we have codified for people to lend those voices, I don't know how we're assured that they will still exist. And I hear you that you say they will, and I'm glad to hear that. I think that there's just a lot of trepidation right now from so many in our campus communities about their sense of belonging and their place on our campuses. So first, I'd like to say that all are welcome on our campuses, no matter what. I think that's very important to state. I'm just concerned that the perception of doing this at this time may create a message that may be, from what I'm hearing from you, a bit unintended. So I just want to put that on the record.
Yeah, no, thanks for saying that. I've heard similar comments, you know, pretty much every day, like I said, because I've been talking to students and faculty and presidents and administrators, and it comes up a lot. And like you, I've been reinforcing, we want everybody to feel welcome on our campus. And we do embrace diversity. I think we can defend diversity every day of the week. You know, it means that we want, of course, as we've talked about before, we want racial diversity. We also want viewpoint diversity. We want ability diversity. We want geographic diversity. We want all kinds of diversity, and we want everybody to feel welcome. So inclusivity and diversity are things that I think we can absolutely lean into. And that's what I'm using the IDEA Council or those people for, is to help you know, figure out how to talk about that in a way, like I said, where we make it very clear we're not abandoning these issues. We're not abandoning any people. You know, we're just removing this group from the code. Those people will still exist. I will still meet with them. And I can't even count the number of settings and groups that talk about these issues. And so I can see, and I feel bad that there's a perception that this means that it's going to be less important. That's not the case. This is simply a matter of removing it from the code because it doesn't need to be there. We still have those conversations. We're not going to stop talking about public safety, and we're not going to stop talking about money either.
Regent Carballo.
Thank you. I do know from my time in leadership on this board and hearing the new business and other suggestions from fellow regents that there is an appetite to review our current committee structure for regents. And I believe Regent Downs had mentioned before that, you know, a fact right now is that our board is going to be going to 9 members, and that in itself will create some obstacles for regent committees. And I wonder if there is a any appetite to in collaboration and in lockstep with looking at those committees, perhaps in the future, that we can look at this at the same time. That would be just a suggestion, and I don't know if that's going to go anywhere or not, but I think maybe it would be helpful to maybe do it in concert with the committee, possible committee restructuring, or at least those discussions. Thank you.
Regent Borland.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the Chancellor bringing this forward, and I trying to understand Regent Carvalho's concerns. I don't. Maybe I'm mixing things up, but how do we make people feel not wanted on our campuses or in NC itself? I had issues with the DEI before, even though we had affirmative action, but we had to have DEI. We had to be politically correct. We had to do this. This is just codifying this stuff, decodifying it. So I'm concerned very, because I've always appreciated that you are concerned that we will be making people feel unwelcome. How is that going to happen? I don't see that happening. We're still the same. Everybody's treated equally. And I like the fact that we have ability, diversity. I think that's what you said. Was that the word?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Love it. 2 words. So we still have the same thing. So what are your concerns, Chair, if you don't mind me asking Regent Carvalho that? Why did you say that? What do you find that might happen if you do this? That people will be unwelcome if we do this? Please.
Mr. Chair, is that okay with you?
I think it would be appropriate, since this is the time for dialogue,
okay,
for regents,
right,
for sure. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
well,
sir.
Well, I've heard from several constituents from different campuses that, most specifically with security, which I think is a very sensitive topic these days on our campuses, and the IDEA Council, because of the, you know, external political environment that has, you know, been a big part of our campus conversations as well. We hear
students who have felt, I mean, we heard it from Jewish students, we've heard it from transgender students, we've heard it from Black students, we've heard it from Hispanic students, that there are times and places that they don't feel safe in some spaces on our campuses. And so to them, I think, and I'm speaking generally now based on what I've heard, that to some of those people, diminishing the role of the IDEA Council may also diminish their voice in certain places.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. With your permission, Chair, I still haven't got what you're saying. I really don't. Because have there been any signs put up saying that you guys are not welcome here? Has anybody said anything, done anything? Do we have any solid reason to believe that? It just seems like it's a leftover from political correctness of the last 4 years. So I just don't understand. No one has told me that they feel any safer or unsafe from before. I know there's a lot of security stuff that needs to be done, but I haven't found that. And like I said earlier, we always had affirmative action. And I don't know
I don't think we're talking affirmative action.
No, I get you. But I'm just saying we've always had that, but we had IDEA Committee, we had DEI, we had ABC, plus one, two, three, or whatever. So I'm lost because I want to see why people don't feel welcome and safe and do something about it.
Well, thank you both for the dialogue. I'd like to move on to Regent Del Carlo, who also has a comment.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. I read this as just achieving, like it said, achieving uniformity in the way the councils are formed. And we've got some councils that are codified. We have some councils that aren't. So we have our choices, really. It's not in we're not given the choice here today. The choice today is to take these out. But we're, as regents, we can change anything. If it doesn't work down the road, we can go back at a later time and codify and then codify all the different councils. So I think it's worth, I want to support our chair or our chancellor. We've hired him to make decisions and look at things and a fresh set of eyes. So I say let's support this today, and then we can always review it at a later time. And when I had my briefing with the chancellor, I said to him, I see this as my thing that I call systemness, because we've got the same functions that our seven teaching institutions, and anything that isn't in a council, whether it's been codified or not codified, things that aren't even being talked about, we should be talking about them, because I see the seven teaching institutions as having very similar functions, and we share ideas. We're not competing with each other, but we're just trying to all get better collectively. So I'm going to support this today and ask that we review it later, maybe a year down the road or so. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Arascata.
I'm going to echo the same sentiments as Regent Del Carlo. Do you stop that? Yes, I'm definitely going to be echo the same sentiments. What I fully feel is that by removing the functionality of these councils, it actually provides them a strengthening, because now it puts the responsibility of even a louder voice on the heavy shoulders of our chancellor to ensure that each of the voices of each of these councils are now absorbed into all of our committees. It gives a voice. I know what it's like not to have a voice, to be judged, to be questioned, to be looked at differently, to have questions raised upon you even before you enter a building. So yes, I think this provides a greater voice for every one of those underrepresented to provide increased diversity, better equity, and accessibility throughout our entire system. It's time that we do this, and it's time that the acronyms and all the other committees that are currently being sunsetted get a better viewpoint throughout all of our system, that they can look down on the mountain and CDOT, they're going to be finally on top and equitable with all the other committees. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. One moment, Regent Boyd. Is there any other?
Yes, sir.
Are there any other regions that have? Regent Bautista.
Regent Bautista, for the record. So, you know, I get the streamlining thing, but if this doesn't really change much, then why even decodify it? What's the purpose? Just to get rid of it?
You know, Chancellor McNair, for the record, not to get rid of it. I mean, we may get rid of that eventually once we get through this first phase of having them redefine some of these things for us so that we can talk about it in ways that is a little bit more inclusive. But like I said, there are countless other groups and countless other settings where these issues come up. I mean, I'll be talking to President Heavey about diversity at UNLV. This council, because it's not in the code, does not mean that we aren't going to be talking about these things. There are, you know, so many other groups that address these things. It should be in the fabric of our DNA. I shouldn't need a council in the code to tell me that this is important. I know that it's important because I hear it from everybody every day. It will continue to be important. So it's mainly about consistency because the other councils aren't codified. And just trying to clean up the code because it's not necessary to have it in there. There's a lot of things that are really important to us that we don't have a council for. And if we put it into a council and then say they were going to get rid of it, people would say, well, it's not important anymore. It was always important. These things, the council and the code isn't what makes it important.
Regent Boyle.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to make a motion to streamline and establish consistency in the handbook by decodifying all of these that's being requested in this. Great. Is that good enough to explain it like that, or should I say each one of them?
I'll reemphasize
the
motion for you.
Yes, sir.
Regent, if we get a second.
I second Regent Del Carlo.
So we have a motion on the floor for a handbook revision for specific to NC councils, and this motion was moved forward by Regent Boyland, seconded by Regent Del Carlo, and this is for the approval of revisions to board policy Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 13, Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 6, and Title IV, Chapter 9B, Section 4. I think based on the conversation that we've had, I'll ask Carrie for a roll call vote. There's more discussion?
Yeah, I wonder.
Sure. Regent Brown.
Thank you so much. Regent Brown, for the record. I will be voting in support of this because I do think it is important to streamline. I've talked about this for almost the 3 years I've been on this board about. I read the handbook. It contradicts each other, and we're slowly undoing that, and I think this is a good step forward. But I also want to say for the record that I find it to be very dangerous when people on this dais say that they've been against DEI, because at its core, that just means that you're against diversity, you're against equity, and you're against inclusion.
No, it is.
So it does make me nervous that when we say things like that, we've got 8 institutions, 7 academic, lots of students, lots of faculty, lots of staff that hear that and that echoes. And so I do want us to be cautious. It is okay to want to make changes, but it is not okay I'm gonna lean on Regent Carvalho, she brought it up. We have heard from a lot of our people. So it is okay to, for me, I wanna codify this, I wanna streamline, I wanna make it match across the system, but I don't want this to be open season on, making people feel less included and less safe. And I don't think that's what this is, but I just wanted to say for the record that at the end of the day, we still want to advocate for those important issues.
Thank you, Regent Brown. I think it's important just to reiterate some of the things that the Chancellor had said specific to this agenda item, and that this is not anything that's taking away from the fact that we want all students to feel inclusive on all of our campuses. And so I think it's important that we recognize that the conversations that we have in terms of students, access, inclusion, that is in everything that we do as regents. And I don't think you can separate that from any one committee or anything, any discussions that we would that we would have. And so I appreciate those comments. If there's no more discussion, then we'll move into a roll call vote.
Chair, I'm sorry, Regent Brown, for the record, I thank you. And I appreciate hearing that from you. But it wasn't you or what the chancellor said that I was referring to. We have 13 people on this committee, and I was referring to one of our colleagues who said in this meeting that they've had a problem with this for a while. So that's what I was referring to. So.
Thank you for clarification, Regent Brown. I'll now ask for a roll call vote. If Chief of Staff Karen Niglojewski can start that for us.
Regent Boylan.
Aye.
Regent Prager.
Yes.
Chair Brooks.
Yes.
Regent Brown.
Yes.
Regent Carvalho.
No.
Regent Del Carlo.
She got it, yes.
Regent Downs.
Yes.
Regent Fernandez.
Yes.
Regent Goicoechea.
Yes.
Vice Chair Goodman.
Yes.
Regent McGrath.
Yes.
Regent Arascada.
Yes.
Regent Batista.
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll now move on to agenda item number 9. This is new business. Are there any regents that have new business requests that they'd like to make? Regent Brown.
Thank you, Regent Brown, for the record. Okay, so as the Nevada System of Higher Education continues to grow with new buildings being built, increased student enrollment, expanding new parts into cities and across the state, and the rise in attendance at athletic events and campus events, it is critical that we take a proactive and strategic approach to supporting our university police department. I propose that the board initiate a comprehensive review of system-wide safety and security planning with a particular focus on ensuring that UPD has the resources, staffing, and infrastructure needed to meet the evolving demands of our campuses. The second item I'd like to bring up is I'd like to request that we develop a policy requiring all ENCHI institutions to create, maintain, and regularly update comprehensive emergency management plans. These plans should align with or exceed the standard established in NRS that requires K-12 schools, public utilities, and resort casinos. Currently, ENCHI institutions are not required to maintain emergency management plans, and this gap leaves campuses vulnerable to disasters and emergencies. The goal of this policy is to strengthen institutional preparedness, protect life and property, and ensure continuity of education, research, and campus operations during emergencies or disasters. And my third item is I would like the board to review the existing policy for the Nevada National Guard tuition waiver program that includes dependents so we can clearly define and evaluate the timeline for when waivers can be passed on to dependents.
Regent Downs.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. I have a few as well, so here we go. Since dual enrollment courses taught by high school personnel who have not undergone the hiring evaluation and even tenure process of ENCHI faculty, not to mention often do not possess the subject matter master's or above as required by instructors at ENCHI institutions, I would like a future agenda item to require the assessment of courses taught by high school personnel to ensure quality and rigor. Current model encourages institutions to enroll as many students as possible without ensuring the rigor we expect of classes taught by system employees. The next one I'd like to revisit, I'm going to keep saying this till we do it, at least until December. I'd like to revisit the Title IV, Chapter 17 assessment of registration fees and consider removing the 10 to 15% assessment on fees. Again, students face increasing costs of education. They do not need to be subsidizing, they do not need to be paying extra funds to subsidize their fellow students. Another one I'd like to see a review of the programs, especially non-academic programs, that have been created by ENCHI institutions to determine if the outreach results of those programs help to, well, the ROI on those programs cover the cost of those programs. Again, if students are expected to pay more for school, then their money should be spent more judiciously. Finally, I'd like to a review of the host account policies for the assistant presidents and chancellor. It'd be helpful to refresh how the host account is to be used and whether the maximum limit needs to be increased to allow better outreach to the community and potential business partners. So with budgetary concerns, it's important to establish better public-private partnerships, and this often begins with hosting business leaders.
Chair Brooks, I have one. This is Regent Del Carlo.
Sure.
Thank you. Because we had that discussion this morning on our first agenda item, I think we need to, as a board, review the pay ranges. And I think that may be coming up at the December meeting. I'm not really sure, but I think we need to have a comprehensive review of all of that. Thank you very much.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to make an agenda to have a future agenda item, and I'd like to invite two other regions to join me in that so that we can put forward our policy in NSHE that males, born males, do not play any sports or join any of our female teams for their safety, and that our teams, our female teams, do not play against any teams that have born males in there. Thank you, sir.
I don't think there's any more new business, correct? So then we're going to jump to agenda item number 10, public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is no public comment at GBC.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None this time.
Thank you. We'll go to public comment here in Las Vegas.
I'll be brief. My name is David Cooper, DavidCooper. I thank the Board of Regents for your decisions today about Nevada State. I also encourage some of the discussions that were made about listening sessions. I highly recommend the Board of Regents reach out to the institutions and hold some more of those listening sessions. I think that was some of the most productive conversations that we have had. And so thank you for your time, and thank you.
SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
There are no callers at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Our meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.